Hi everyone, this is Shantae with Soul Care University, and I have a special guest today for our Soul Time. So as a reminder, this is a time when I like to talk with my fellow wise woman healers and light workers about what they're doing in the community to preserve this folk healing on its many levels. So our guest today is Oisa Vandenberg. And she is not only my dear sister friend, she is a registered mental health counseling intern for the state of Florida. She just recently graduated several months ago from Rollins College in the mental health counseling program. And I am really excited to talk to her about the subject of death and dying. I think it's something here in the America that we do not talk enough about. And so I'm really excited to listen to how she's going to weave death and dying and the process of death and dying and supporting us in this process and how it relates to folk healing. So welcome, Oisa.
Thank you, Shantae. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here. So Oisa and I go back quite a few moons. We definitely have a connection through our children and our family, and we live in the same community. And we met at a women's circle years ago. So we have that connection through Howling at the Moon every couple of years, and it's always really fun. So I'm really excited to talk with Oisa. So Oisa, you recently shared with me that I didn't know that you won an award. And I would love for you to talk to us about the reward, because I think it'll give us a backdrop as to the population that you're most passionate about.
Great. Well, thank you. So there's an association in the Americas that's called Association for Death Education and Counseling. And it's actually an international organization, and it's not very well known outside its own death and dying and grief and bereavement circles, but they give an award to a graduate student each year, and sometimes there goes a year without one. So I was really honored and pleased to learn that I had won the award, and my paper was on instilling hope in the counseling situation with those who are facing end of life or have lost a loved one. Because sometimes hope is always considered hope for a cure. And there are situations in which there are no cures. We can't fix it. And there is, you know, only one assured thing in our life, and that is that we will die. And so sometimes we get caught in this space of believing there's a cure, and so we lose hope because we can't have a cure.
Yeah.
So my paper was about instilling a new kind of hope, reframing hope, if you will, to understand that I can still hope for a good death. I can hope to be surrounded by family. I can hope to be at home. I can hope to be comfortable. I can hope to be pain-free. I actually have a great deal of hope at end of life when I've removed the hope for cure off of the table. And so it's really important, I think, for counselors and healers and people who are supporting those who are coming up against the dying process and their family members to support them by recognizing that there is a great deal of hope. There's a great deal of life left. No one's dead until they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the dying process, they're still living. There's still a place for them to grow, to connect, to leave a legacy, to share love. I mean, it's a really poignant time where a lot of healing can happen.
Yeah. Wow. Just have to take a breath on that. I know just starting the conversation about talking about death and dying and having hope, just as you were talking, I found my mind kind of tracing back to those people that I have lost. You know, my mother, my father, my in-law, my father-in-law. It just kind of went right back there. And it went right back to those moments, those last moments And then it went back to where I didn't have any last moments. And, you know, I can feel it in my heart space. It's like, oh my gosh, I didn't know I was going to respond this way, which I love and I hate all at the same time.
Right. Right.
Oh my gosh. Right. It hits me right in that core. So it's like, oh, I know this is such a conversation that we need to talk about, especially in our culture here in America. And so that kind of brings me to the question, why do you think this death and dying process is not honored here?
So there's evidence and history that around the turn of the century, when both birth and death became hospitalized, and we can go down the rabbit hole of conversation about why, but it just did, right? So birth and death became both hospitalized behind a closed doors in a sterile environment, and for a lot of good reasons. But the unintended consequence of that is that people began to believe that whatever happened behind that closed door was either scary or something to be avoided.
Mm.
So birth wasn't an awareness anymore. Death was no longer an awareness anymore. Our population shifted from an agricultural awareness to an urban environment. So we no longer saw the lambs born in the spring. We no longer saw the calves born over the summer. We no longer saw the old horse die over the winter. Like we stopped seeing birth and death as sort of a natural extension of the natural order of things, right? And for a lot of really good reasons, right? Women were dying in childbirth at horrible rates, right? So there's some really positive things, obviously, about hospitalizing births and deaths, but we ended up medicalizing them in a way that makes them feel scary and something that needs to be put away or not seen.
Yeah.
So my intention certainly is to, because I'm so involved with the birth midwife community, I kept seeing how important the death midwife community could be. And just started saying, what does it mean to bring birth home in safe and applicable situations, right? Like you wouldn't take high-risk pregnancies at home, but low-risk pregnancies are perfect at home. Well, what's to say that a low-risk death couldn't also be handled in the same way at home?
Yes. So that's a new term that I've only heard because you mentioned it a year or so ago, is a death midwife.
Yeah.
So, like, tell us about that, because that feels good.
Yeah. So when I started down this path, I didn't know it existed in that form until I started doing some research. And in the Americas, there might be a little bit on the East Coast and a little bit in some of the more progressive states that have death with dignity provisions in their state statutes, like Oregon and California. I think I can't remember if it's Vermont or New Hampshire, but one of the more progressive eastern states as well. But even then, it's pretty small. It's and many of those are called death doulas. But in the UK and Canada is where it's really been strong over the last 20 years. And those death midwives have really started using social media to promote and encourage people to learning about what a home death looks like, what a home funeral looks like, what an organic, I don't like the wording, using the word disposal, but caring for the body after, so there are a lot of different opportunities and choices in that. And most people have the presumption that the second somebody dies, oh no, the funeral director has to rush in and go embalm the body and put makeup on, you know, that. And that's terrifying. Not only that, but the fracture of the relationship is so abrupt that people sort of lose parts of their soul in that experience. And so learning about it and having the body stay at home and washing the body and tending the body and sitting in vigil over the body, laying with the body, loving the body as it starts to just gently change. It takes more than 3 days before the body even starts to change, which nobody knows about that, right? Everybody thinks, oh.
Yes.
And it is in its gentleness, it allows people to feel connected to the body and allows the brain, and then we have lots of neurological insights about that, but it allows the body to start accepting the loss, right?
Yeah.
As it's working with the body and recognizing that the person is gone,
right,
out of the body, then the mind can better understand in the course of those 3 days what's happening.
Yes.
Family can come, they can bring food, they can sit in vigil with each other, they can say goodbye to the body themselves, they can learn. There's no time limit to it. There's no, oh, at 3 o'clock we show up and at 4 o'clock we drive in the hearse to the cemetery, right?
Yeah.
It's this sort of organic return in some ways to the old ways, right?
Yeah.
To the ways of our grandmothers and our great grandmothers.
Yes, yes. And that right there is folk medicine at its finest.
Yeah.
So where it's not happening here, is there anywhere where this death midwifery is happening?
So there's a wonderful woman by the name of Sarah Kerr, K-E-R-R. Y'all can look her up on Facebook. She's in Calgary, Canada. And then there's another woman whose name has slipped my mind at the moment, but she's probably the leading edge midwife in the UK. And if you just did, you know, UK midwife, death midwife, it would pop up for her.
Yeah.
I think it's called, Soul Passages. But so those two places where hospice has also originated, right? Hospice.
Right.
In the UK. So those two places have really extended the hospice arm and mission about being, you know, a wayside home for those to provide comfort, provide pain relief, to ease suffering. And because their medical model is a little different and their insurance situations are a little different, they've been able to create an adjunct support system that's actually, you know, they get paid to be with a family from either diagnosis or choice of hospice to walk the family through a home death and a home funeral, and then support the family in grief and bereavement afterwards.
Right. And it sounds like, as you're talking, because when I think of midwifery of a birth, you know, you talk with your midwife and you lay out the different things that you would like at your birth, who you would like to be there and who's going to support you at this particular stage and that particular stage. And so it feels like with this death midwifery that it's not cookie cutter. It's like you get to sit down with this midwife and you get to talk about, and that's part of the process of the grieving process, that you get to talk about how you want things to unfold and what you would like there. And it just seems really, really, really beautiful, because I know that we'll often focus on like picking out caskets and picking out the plot of like where, you know, maybe if it's a married couple, like where the couple's going to be in case one goes before the other, and so they kind of, but there's no time to talk about, there isn't any space to talk about how they would like for their death to be.
That's right.
And I find that to be fascinating, scary, and refreshing all at the same time.
Yeah, right? So we have a lot of cultural stereotypes about death, right? So consider how you are even responding to this conversation, right? Like, are you icked out, right? Are you You know, is it terrifying to think, oh my gosh, I might sit in the same room with a dead body? I mean, death from the moment of that film became a thing, and then certainly television afterwards, death is only shown as something that's either quick, like grandpa takes his last breath and then he's gone.
Yeah.
Or terrifying, horrific, dramatic, you know, gory, all of the, like, death is never shown culturally in any way that feels safe and comfortable.
Yes. And so we've all been programmed.
We've all been programmed
to have a certain way. So, which comes to when we look at, you know, the indigenous worldview. I know I have seen different documentaries and different things about funerals and other and more indigenous cultures, and they're amazing.
Yeah.
They're absolutely flat out, I want to move over to the bush because I want to have a death like that. Like, that's just crazy amazing. And so I wonder, just what can we learn? What can we take from that indigenous? And you probably kind of already answered the question, but like, what can we take from this indigenous worldview about death and dying and this grieving process and kind of adopt and bring it into our own culture?
Right. So I think if I could sum it up, it would be that they have a death positive worldview. A death positive worldview.
I love that. Yep. And it's true. So what led you, like, what sparked you?
Right.
Want to work with this?
So, you know, 100 different stories pop into my head, but when I'm really reflecting on the death positive worldview, I think it's because for whatever reason, my mother and my grandmother had a death positive worldview. Now, whether or not they would have defined it that way, I'm not entirely sure. But because death was just a natural part of their lives, because my grandmother never left the farm, right? And my mother only left the farm when she got married at 20 or so. Death was always just a part of what you did. So when great aunt Elsie died, the women went and washed her and dressed her, and they never left her until it was time for the funeral director to get her. So they had a blended piece to it. But my mom was, from the earliest time that I can think of, she was planning her funeral. She told me what song she wanted us to sing. She told us what she, you know, it's just always been something that's been part of what she's really, now, you know, you could argue that it was because she's a control freak and wanted to make sure. I get that. But, you know, it's just always been a part of my DNA, if you will. To be comfortable around that. In addition, and maybe because of that comfortableness, I'm not sure, but when I was a young mother, Mackenzie was only about 2, I had a very precious friend of mine die of HIV and AIDS. In Southwest Michigan, and it was still, I mean, this was like 95, which, you know, everybody knew about HIV and AIDS, but there was still a lot of stereotypes around it, a lot of fear around it. So the only people that would attend to him were the hospice nurses. And they were so loving and so caring, and we sat in vigil, and I learned so much from them just in the 2 weeks of his course of dying. And I was so comfortable with it that it really felt like, whether or not I didn't know at the time that I had found a career, as much as I had just found a place where I knew that I was best served. And then in subsequent family losses or friend losses. I've assisted at the death and just had a strong response from people around me. Wow, how did you know to do that?
Mm-hmm.
What made you want to do this? Wow, what an angel you are to be there. And, you know, just really getting positive feedback that said to me, whatever I'm doing by instinct is right.
Yeah.
And now I need to learn more so that I can be of even greater service. So that's really where it sent me down the path of becoming, you know, a master's level counselor, so that not only do I have the credentials to be able to be in those places and be paid, you know, it's both career and vocation, right?
Right, right.
But also so that I had access to information and trainings that can serve people on a bigger scale.
Right.
So that, and in my learning about that whole death process, I really learned that grief is impacted and can become very complicated if the death event is not supportive, is not healthy. And people, you know, there's a great deal of evidence and people way smarter than me that talk about how PTSD is often just unresolved grief.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, you know, traumas as adults are often a result of traumas sustained early on that are completely unresolved. You know, when a three-year-old loses a parent, they don't have the bandwidth to understand what that is. And if they're shushed away and everything disappears about that parent instantly and never talked about again, it leaves a gaping, gaping hole.
Yeah.
That then the 30-year-old who loses even, say, a pet, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Who has their first loss, there's no fallback for them. And all of that three-year-old loss history comes pouring in and they're swamped.
Yes.
Swamped.
Absolutely. Wow. Wow. So it feels very intuitive. It feels very spiritual. And I'm wondering how your own spiritual work and your own spiritual development and your own inner work is impacted by this work.
Sure. Well, first of all, I always feel very humble in the face of families who allow me into their sacred space and trust me.
Yeah.
This is never about me, right?
Yeah.
And it's always about them being courageous enough and brave enough to allow an outsider into their most tender, vulnerable spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I just take that so preciously, because it's not a place that most people are willing to share, even with themselves, let alone an outsider.
Yeah.
Mm. So I have to get really clear in terms of my own spiritual work and my own mental health work.
Mm-hmm.
I have to get really, really clear that this is not about me. I'm not healing my grief. I'm not healing my losses. I'm not doing any of my work in their space.
Right.
Because I'll never completely do it all, right?
Right.
But I've done a great deal of it so that I can be fully present for them and be the hollow bone.
Yeah.
So that they can use me and my skills and my knowledge in a way that best serves that family.
Yes. Yes. And I love the way you said that family, because I would imagine all the different customs and all the different beliefs that we all have separately.
Absolutely.
And being able to, like, how does a practitioner do that? To be able to come into a situation and be open and not put their own values into the situation.
Right. Yeah, so that's probably, that's where I get a little steel in my backbone, right?
Right.
Because this is not about me telling them how they're supposed to be dying.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about me telling them how they're supposed to be worshiping or paying attention to their family of origin religion, right? This is not about me in any way, shape, or form when it comes to what their traditions are, what their customs are, what their beliefs are. So I don't need to know what their beliefs are. People say, oh, how do I attend a Muslim death? How do I attend a Jewish death? How do I attend a pagan death? How do I attend an atheist death? You just attend the death.
And you
learn from that family what is appropriate and what isn't.
Yes.
And you ask the open questions. How would you like to do this? How would you like to do that? Tell me about your history. Tell me about your life beliefs. And I really come in, or I hope to come in, as a blank slate in terms of expectations.
Yeah.
I'm not a blank slate about what I know, right? But I am a blank slate about my expectations. Because it is family-led. And here's the kicker about that. I will not be perfect. I will make mistakes. I will stick my foot in my mouth. It's guaranteed.
Yes, yes, yes.
And here's the beauty of whether it's training or instinct. I really can't tell you. But here is what I have learned. Because I will make mistakes, if I own those mistakes, if I humbly ask for forgiveness of my mistakes, if I gratefully tell them to teach me as a humble servant, then the next time I probably won't make the same mistake. And it shows the family that I am adaptable.
Yeah.
I am flexible, and we can repair the relationship.
Yes.
And that, like, therapeutic.
Hugely therapeutic. Hugely. I was thinking of, and you helped me a lot through my father-in-law's death. Just did some amazing coaching. And I'll never forget, my father-in-law was just kind of hanging on.
Right.
And you made a suggestion to me to suggest to my husband.
Right.
And when I made the suggestion to him, he was really clear. He's like, Black people don't do that.
Right.
They just don't. And so I was like, well, okay. And I brought that back to you and we laughed about it, but I had to find a way to suggest something to him that was uncomfortable, but you know, how I had to ask him, well, what would be comfortable for you? You know, how could you be able to invite, you know, our kids to be able to say goodbye? Like, you know, how do we do that? And it was because of the conversation that I had with you when we thought that he was going to cross over one evening and nobody was there, that I was like, we're getting on the phone, guys, and we're calling the place. And we're going to have the nurse put the phone up to his ear. And I had the kids say goodbye.
Yeah.
And tell them how much they loved him and told them their favorite things that they loved about him. And I could just hear him just like grunting and making noises on the phone. And it was awesome. And yeah, we were crying and the kids were crying. But I know how good that felt for them to say those things.
Right.
Even though he lasted several more days,
they
had that opportunity just to be in the moment. And I'm forever grateful for that wisdom that you shared That was invaluable.
Thank you. And the two parts to that that I want to address is that first, I'm so grateful that you had an open enough heart to hear the intent behind the suggestion,
yes,
rather than just how I sort of indelicately put it, right?
Right.
And that, you know, the whole family is part of the grieving, letting go process. It's not just person, right? So that it was as important for him maybe to hear the goodbyes as it was for the children and the other family members to say their goodbyes.
Yeah.
Right? It's not either or, it's both.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part that I really love about that story is that, yeah, white folk have a silly way of doing things sometimes, you know? And I'm telling you, and sometimes we're too direct, right? We don't take time to recognize the history of the family dynamic and how that would come across, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I learned from that was so important and profound for me is that, hey, wait a minute. Find out first how you do say goodbye, right?
Mm-hmm.
Telling the person, oh, you should say goodbye. How have you said goodbye in the past? You know, what sort of traditions center around losses in your family? Like spending some more time opening that place up.
Yeah.
So that the family gets the idea, oh, we could do it this way instead of the expert in the room telling you what you should do. So
yeah.
I'm so grateful that I made that mistake with someone like you who can be very forgiving.
Yeah. I hear you.
Instead of with a family that, you know, that might be the door shutting right then, because
mm-hmm.
I don't get them and then they're done. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's so you do walk a very tender walk with that. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to not only, I don't want to say apologize in a way that somehow it was harmful, but in a way that allowed me to learn. And you still got the information that was necessary for your children and father-in-law. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And you're welcome. And that's the nature of our relationship. And most of my relationships that are close is that we learn from each other and we support each other. And it just, we listen, you know, that mindfulness listening and understanding.
Right?
So it's just... That's for me, that's a true friend.
Yeah.
So
it is.
That's what that is about. And I love kind of as we wrap up, I love the piece because our Soul Time conversations with Soul Care U really is about the preservation of folk healing and folk medicine. And for me, folk medicine and folk healing is that which our grandmothers and grandfathers have done.
Right.
That have been passed down in our family. And so I love that your mother and your grandmother, though they may not have called it that, had a death positive worldview because that was something they passed on to you. So it's like you are carrying on the tradition of this very, as I see, very ancient since the beginning of time.
Right.
Folk medicine that is so needed in our modern culture. So I want to humbly bow to you and say thank you for preserving this way of dying.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about it too, because it you know, with each conversation, I get clearer and and it becomes more real about, you know, what path the is unfolding for this work and for the coming together, right, of all of
right? Absolutely. So I know we didn't talk about it kind of pre-interview, but did you want to provide any of your information of ways anyone could reach out to you? To if they had questions or if they want to just kind of connect and talk. I didn't know if you were set up for anything like that.
Yeah, at the moment, actually, I'm interviewing at a couple of different places that will hopefully have that element for
awesome.
Me. If not, right, and if not, then by the first of the year, I'll be in private practice. So I'm still in that research and development stage. But
yes.
If anyone a couple of things. If anyone's feeling particularly triggered, or you know, something's coming up for them about their own loss history and grief, I would really encourage them to reach out to their, you know, their own counselor or therapist if they have somebody.
Definitely.
But if anybody's just really interested in learning more, certainly they can get to me through email through you, Miss.
Yeah.
So
awesome.
Just have them contact you and you can put them in touch with me and I'd be happy to further the conversation.
That is perfect. And yes, for sure. That's Soul Care You. And I'll make sure there's an email that is attached to this so people can reach out. Oh, thank you, Owaisa, so much for sharing your time and just having a nice, just soul time conversation. It was lovely. Just lovely.
And it's lovely out here on my porch with the little light breeze and the little misty rain. It's just been a perfect afternoon. So I appreciate
awesome.
The opportunity so much,
oh,
my dear.
You are so welcome. And thank you so much for joining us on this call and just kind of listening in. It has been amazing. And we will talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.